FMR 101.3 FM.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. I saw a book with a cover that really, I thought, what on earth? It's clearly a doctor's book. There's a stethoscope and one or two other things, and then an ice cream cone with some red ice cream in it. And then I looked at the title, Prescription Ice Cream, an engaging memoir about the highs and lows of working as a medical doctor in South Africa, and how, with a little help from metal music and ice cream, this doctor was able to struggle on, find meaning in the chaos, and, most importantly, to inspire others. And I'm talking about Alistair McAlpine, who is a palliative paediatrician and who decided to share some of his thoughts from the children in his care. And their simple yet profound answers went viral, found their way into homes across the world, and touched the hearts of millions. And this book is the result. Prescription Ice Cream. You can't miss it on the bookshelves because of the ice cream standing there. Alistair, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I know you're doing a few book launches of this, aren't you, around the country, in fact.
That's right. We had a very successful book launch at Exclusive Books in Hyde Park in Johannesburg last week. Huge attendance. We were kindly sponsored by Magnum Ice Creams, who gave us a whole fridge of free ice cream.
Oh, so there are literally ice creams there?
We gave free ice creams to everybody. It was wonderful, very, very successful. Couldn't find enough seating for everyone. And then just this weekend, we were at the Franschhoek Literary Festival, where the Creamery gave a discount to everyone who had come to my talk with Africa Milane. And coming up, we have a few more events, including a book launch in Cape Town, as well as some other book festivals. So very, very busy, but also really exciting.
So this has really taken off, hasn't it? Is it your first book ever?
Yes, oh, absolutely. You know, I'm a physician by trade, and I'm an enthusiastic reader, but certainly never written before. Writing a book is incredibly hard work. Writing this book was incredibly hard work. But yes, this is the first book I've ever written, and I given how difficult it was, I'm not sure if there will be any more.
Well, it looks as though it's going to be quite popular, and we're going to persuade people to go and have a look and buy one as well. But just there's a story about how it came into being, which I'm quite interested in your telling us and sharing with us.
Yes, so I was just a physician doing palliative care in Cape Town and minding my own business, and doing palliative pediatrics is quite tough on the soul because you're dealing with children who are facing severe and life-limiting conditions. And I was feeling really quite glum and down about it. But what was amazing was that my patients were not. They had managed to find real joy and happiness, and I couldn't believe it. And so I said to a few of them, "What is it that makes you happy?" And the things they told me were so sort of beautiful and profound and simple and true that I figured that I had to share it. So during my lunch hour, I sat down and just fired off a couple of tweets. I didn't think anything of it. And then within 48 hours, the tweets had circled the globe. Well over 20 million people had read the threads.
What?
I had been interviewed by Sky, BBC, CNN. Really, I had my 15 minutes of fame, so to speak, before I was replaced on the news cycle. But it was a really, really popular thread. And that is the thread that inspired the book, where I was approached and was asked to provide the context behind what led up to that thread, and also a sort of a deeper exploration of what it was like to work with children in palliative care, and how I ultimately got to the point of writing that thread.
It's interesting that you said right at the beginning there, Alistair, how emotionally draining it must be for you. I remember once being invited to go to the Red Cross Children's Hospital, and I said no, because I couldn't bear the thought of seeing children suffering, let alone children who are terminally ill. So that must be a bit tough on you as well.
It is tough, and it's one of the reasons I'm not in palliative care at the moment. I was involved for 18 months, and it was perhaps the most profound and meaningful 18 months of my life. But it's not something that I have the heart and soul to be able to do for years and years and years. So I've moved away to infectious diseases now, pediatric infectious diseases. But working with those kids with Pete's pal in Cape Town was perhaps the greatest honor of my life.
My goodness. Now, you, in your book, have published one of the threads, haven't you, or the main thread?
That's correct.
Are you prepared to read something for
us? Yes, absolutely. And, of course, I mean, you don't need to buy the book to read the thread. It's available on X/Twitter. But for anyone who's interested, I'll quickly go through it now. So the thread was published on the 1st of February 2018, and it begins as follows. For an assignment, I asked some of my terminal pediatric palliative care patients what they had enjoyed in life and what gave it meaning. Kids can be so wise, you know. Here are some of the responses. First, none wished they'd watched more TV. None said they should have spent more time on Facebook. None said they enjoyed fighting with others. None enjoyed hospital. Many mentioned their pets. I love Rufus. His funny bark makes me laugh. I love when Ginny snuggles up to me at night and purrs. I was happiest riding Jake on the beach. Many mentioned their parents, often expressing worry or concern. Hope Mum will be okay. She seems sad. Dad mustn't worry. He'll see me again soon. God will take care of my mum and dad when I'm gone. All of them loved ice cream. All of them loved books or being told stories, especially by their parents. Harry Potter made me feel brave. I love stories in space. I want to be a great detective like Sherlock Holmes when I'm better. Folks, read to your kids. They love it. Many wish they had spent less time worrying about what others thought of them and valued people who just treated them normally. My real friends didn't care when my hair fell out. Jane came to visit after the surgery and didn't even notice the scar. Many of them loved swimming and the beach. I made big sandcastles. Being in the sea with the waves was so exciting, my eyes didn't even hurt. Almost all of them valued kindness above all other virtues. My granny is so kind to me. She always makes me smile. Johnny gave me half his sandwich when I didn't eat mine. That was nice. I like it when that kind nurse is here. She's gentle, and it hurts less. Almost all of them loved people who made them laugh. That magician is so silly. His pants fell down and I couldn't stop laughing. My daddy pulls funny faces, which I just love. The boy in the bed next to me farted. Laughter relieves pain. Kids love their toys and their superheroes. My Princess Sophia doll is my favorite. I love Batman. All boys love Batman. I like cuddling my teddy. Finally, they all valued time with their family. Nothing was more important. Mum and Dad are the best. My sister always hugs me tight. No one loves me like Mummy loves me. Take home message. Be kind. Read more books. Spend time with your family. Crack jokes. Go to the beach. Hug your dog. Tell that special person you love them. These are the things these kids wish they could have done more. The rest is details. Oh, and eat more ice cream.
Gosh. That's quite something. And that's what you sat in the canteen during your lunchtime writing down.
That's what they told me.
Twitter.
That's right. And I just fired it off. And the response was completely overwhelming. And a lot of people really related. It got retweeted hundreds of thousands of times. And that's really what sparked the ultimate idea for the book. And for anyone sort of curious about the book, it's divided into three parts, and my journey through palliative care and chatting to those kids makes up the third part of the book.
All right. We're going to talk about the book in considerably more detail in a moment, Alistair, but I'm slightly concerned about your first choice of music. We do break the rule, I have to tell you, on People of Note from time to time, but I think you might be the first person in the history of this program who's chosen Metallica, a heavy metal band. Am I going to let you get away with it?
I was secretly hoping when I came here that I would be the first person to get away with a metal song on Fine Music Radio.
I think you are, just for the record.
Metal music plays a big part in the book, which we'll explore a bit later. I'm someone who loves fine music, but I also love extreme metal, which a lot of people find very surprising when they meet me. Just so that your listeners are not worried, I'm not about to break anybody's ears, but the first song is, and what I've tried to do is take a a slightly gentler metal song and really combine it with symphonic elements that the listeners will hopefully appreciate. The first song features one of the most famous bands in all of metal. They're so famous that even non-metal heads have usually heard of them, and it's American band Metallica. They featured with the San Francisco Symphonic Orchestra about 20 years ago. They played a couple of shows with them. It was recorded onto an album called S&M, San Francisco Orchestra and Metallica. This was a song written by Michael Kamen specifically for this concert, and I think it's one of the best Metallica songs I've heard, and I hope people like it. And if you don't like it, that's okay. It's not that long. It'll end soon.
Yeah.
Well, I think that is a first. To have Metallica, the heavy metal band, on Fine Music Radio is a bit of a thing. No Leaf Clover. I hope we haven't lost any listeners on the way, Alistair.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I, for a long time, was not into metal music. I didn't understand it. I felt, why would anyone listen to music where the person is screaming at you, where it's incomprehensibly loud and dissonant, and I wasn't into metal. And then when I was in rehab, which I talk about in the book, I found myself in rehabilitation for alcoholism. I remember one day I was just overwhelmed with anxiety and depression, and my roommate, who was this very charismatic Welsh guy, said, you should just listen to this. And he put something, this was a few years ago, so I had a Discman. So he put a CD into my Discman, and I listened, and this cacophonous noise just completely overwhelmed me. And it was loud and brutal, and I didn't like it very much. And it ended, and I said to him, you know, thank you, but I'm really not sure that this is my thing. And he said to me, that's fine. But he said to me, while that was all going on, what were you thinking about? And I said, I wasn't thinking about anything. And he said, exactly. And what I discovered was that for people like me who often have brains that are constantly whirring a million miles an hour and are often overwhelmed with anxiety and concern and thinking about tomorrow and everything, there is something that is so overwhelming about the music that it's almost like a blanket just gets put over my brain. And for the few minutes or whatever that I'm listening to the music, it's so all-consuming that I can't think about anything else. And there is peace and joy to be found in that, which is something that I've carried on. And that's why these days I'm such an enthusiastic metalhead, because I find a lot of peace. And people laugh at me when I say I listen to extreme death metal before I go to bed. But it's true, because I find the peace that it provides to be something that no other genre of music, except perhaps fine music, can provide.
That's very interesting and a completely unexpected answer approach, really, that it made you think of nothing. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
If you do have a very highly active brain. Gosh, and classical music? Do you ever listen to classical music?
I love classical music. My mom, from a young age, I think she played me Mozart in utero. I'm a big fan of going to the orchestra. And I actually believe, and a lot of metalheads would agree with me, that there are many parallels between classical music and metal music. And that's why so many bands combine the two to such great effects.
As you said with this concert that we've just
heard. Exactly. Yeah. And they're not the first band to do that. But the idea of sort of this incredibly overwhelming, often bombastic, often very subtle, sort of hugely emotional form of music that does not conform to verse, chorus, verse, but often moves in movements and, has valleys and waves. I think that there are huge parallels between the two, which is why a lot of people, myself included, like both.
Oh, that's, well, good. Then you're allowed to stay,
Alistair. Thank you.
I'm talking to Alistair McAlpine about his new book called Prescription Ice Cream. Just before we go back to the book, although I know that you've just said, confessed about sobriety and having an alcohol problem, was this brought on, do you think, by the stress of work? Because I know you started at Barragronnaith, or what caused that?
So I actually developed my alcohol problem before I even started as a doctor. It began in earnest in medical school, and as is documented in the second part of the book, I ultimately got suspended from medical school as a result of my alcoholism. I started drinking quite late, by some people's standards, I guess. I really only started drinking when I was 16 or 17. And my descent was so rapid that by the time I was 21, I was essentially a full-blown alcoholic, and had been expelled or suspended from medical school. My life was in tatters. My partner at the time had left me. And, I found myself where no one wants to find themselves, which is in rehab, because no one goes to rehab because your life is going great. And so a lot of the book is about documenting that journey. And truthfully, when I was writing the book, a large part of me didn't want to include that, because there's still a huge stigma around alcoholism, around substance abuse, around addiction, and in particular in the medical field where it is so rife mental health and addiction is a huge problem amongst healthcare workers, and it's a secret that no one talks about, because we all think that doctors need to be these perfect human beings who have everything under control, and we forget that we're just flesh and blood and have weaknesses like everybody else. But there's a more pernicious aspect to it, in that if you ever do seek help for any kind of mental health condition, it's like a black mark on your career that follows you around. Every time you seek registration, you get asked, do you have any mental health issues? And you are then forced to disclose that. So to avoid that, many health professionals don't seek the help that they need because they don't want that black mark. And the problem is, it ultimately results in us dying. We die at greater rates than other professions. We take our own lives. It's really, it's a real problem. And so a part of me hopes that maybe in some small way, writing openly about it will open up the conversation about mental health and addiction and healthcare, because it's a bigger problem than we recognize.
And what the nice thing is about that section of the book is it's so readable. You know, you're not writing down, you're not talking down to people. I found it completely, fascinating, actually, just because of the way you wrote it. So, and that's the sort of middle, because you said the book's in three sections.
That's
the
correct.
First, when you were an intern, then your life with alcohol and the other things that happened, and then more on the children.
That's right.
So that's something else we have to talk about. But I'm going to take just a break now after talking about, and thank you for being so open about that. As you say, doctors tend to keep quiet about it. And you've been sober now for?
The better part of 20 years.
That's, well, good going for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Your next song, Within Temptation, Ice Queen. Now, what do we have?
So Within Temptation is a Dutch symphonic metal band. And what these bands do is they really take this. Within Temptation is sort of famous in symphonic metal circles, been around since the late 90s. Usually what they combine is a sort of a ethereal female singer with bombastic guitars and then the symphony. It can be quite cheesy, so the way to enjoy this music is to really lean into the cheese rather than to make fun of it. And when you sort of embrace that it's supposed to be over the top, it can be a lot of fun. So I hope the listeners enjoy this one. And also, if you don't like it, it's not a very long song. We're not talking a 20-minute symphony. So, we hope you'll hang on even if you don't like it.
Well, here I am being a sort of DJ announcing Ice Queen within Temptation. That was another choice of my guest, Alistair McAlpine, who, as we've discovered, is a metalhead, but more importantly, a doctor involved in palliative pediatrician. Well, now you said you're not doing that at the moment, did you?
Correct. So currently I'm an infectious diseases pediatrician, but for a few months, just over sort of a year and a half back in 2017, 2018, I was in palliative pediatrics through PEDSPAL, which is an organization based in Cape Town, and we would service all the pediatric hospitals in the Western Cape.
Yeah, but now you don't work in Cape Town anymore. You work in Canada.
That's correct. I was offered a post to do some additional training in Canada, and I've been working there for a few years. I would love to come back. My partner and I miss South Africa every single day. It has its problems, but there are no people like South Africans. And if I can get a job, then I would love to come back.
Would you go back to pediatrics?
Well, I'm in pediatrics. It's my specialty. So I would always do pediatrics. Whether I would go back to palliative care or not, I'd have to think quite long and hard about it.
But now, getting back to your book, Ice Cream, Prescription Ice Cream, with the large red ice cream cone on the cover. It's, as you said, in three sections, but the first section really sort of took me back. Any desire to become a doctor, had I read that when I was leaving school, because you went as an intern to Barrow Gwynedd. Really, it's got such a reputation, good and bad, that hospital. And what you wrote, I thought, goodness, how did you survive? But you did and you had to.
Yes, that's correct. So for those who don't know, when you finish your 5 or 6 years of medical school, you go into 2 years of internship. And I did mine at Chris Hani Barrow Gwynedd Hospital in Soweto, which at the time was the biggest hospital in the world with well over 3,000 beds. I think it's third now. And it's a wild place to work. And you are dumped in there in the thick of it with very, very little preparation, and it can be extremely overwhelming. The things you see and the adventures that you have are, yeah, they're crazy. But like you said, there's very much a sense of brothers in arms with your fellow interns, that you're all going through this almost like a war zone together. Yeah. And so the bonds that you form are absolutely incredible. And I'm still in touch with almost all of my friends who I made while I was working there. But I think you really nailed it, where there's good and bad. One of the great things about Barrow Gwynedd was that even as an intern, the capacity to do good is extraordinary. In so many other hospitals, interns are glorified scribes or messengers. The consultants and the registrars do all the hard yards. At Barrow, it's so big that huge amount of responsibility is placed on the interns, which means that you really can do so much good, which is exactly why many of us went into medicine. The flip side to that coin is it's so busy and overwhelming that often you don't have time to do all the things you want to do because the next patient is waiting and you've got a whole queue of people outside, and the longer you delay, the longer that queue gets. So certainly, as I think I hope comes through in the book, my feelings towards Barrow Gwynedd are mixed. I'm grateful for the incredible training I got there, but also I had to give up a piece of my soul to be able to navigate how busy it was, and that is a little bit harder to swallow.
It was interesting, I thought, the nurses and sisters, the people you worked with, seemed to be very professional, but also fairly supportive. I got that impression from most of them, and didn't really look down on you as a feeble intern.
I think the thing is, some of the nurses have been there for 30 years, and they have seen 30 years of interns come and go, and the interns will ultimately leave, but they remain. So they've seen it all, and I think they size up very quickly who are the ones who know what's going on, but also who are the ones who show them respect. Because one of the biggest mistakes you can make as an intern is to disregard what the nurses have to say. When an experienced nurse says, come, you come. You come immediately. You drop what you're doing and you come. And so, you know, a lot of the nurses in South Africa have a bit of a bad rap, and that's because nursing is a tough job to do in South Africa with very poor pay and very long hours. But let me tell you, good nurses and experienced nurses are absolutely golden. And as an intern, that was something I learned very quickly.
How long were you at Barra as an intern?
So I was there for 2 years as an intern, and then I stayed on for another year for my community service year. So I was there for a total of 3 years.
And in that 3 years, did you get the gist of the whole place? Did you get it sort of under your skin?
Yeah,
or is it impossible to do that with a hospital like that?
It's hard to say. I mean, there was a quote on the one of the notice boards that I walked past every single day, and the quote said, "You don't change Barra. Barra changes you." People have tried to alter that hospital, but it's almost like this monolith that will not be moved. So I was there for 3 years, and certainly felt very changed and altered by my experiences there. I don't think I changed the hospital one bit.
But it clearly had a huge effect on you.
Yes, indeed.
And when you came out of the internship at Barra, where did you go then?
So when I did my internship and then community service year, which is a requirement for all South African doctors who wish to practice. At that stage, I then realized that I wanted to do pediatrics. And so I went about getting more experience. So I worked for a while at the Rahima Musa Hospital, pediatric hospital in Johannesburg. And then I went down to Cape Town and spent some time getting experience at Red Cross Children's Hospital and Groote Schuur.
I wonder what made you want to go the pediatric route. Is there an answer to that?
So throughout my medical school and indeed as an intern, I always thought I would go into adult medicine. And that was because adult medicine is very cerebral. It's very, you sit there and you think and you ponder and you come up with a differential diagnosis and you discuss, and I love that kind of thing. But what I found was, while adult medicine appealed to me intellectually, it didn't appeal to me emotionally, because it felt at times a little bit like, you know, a treadmill where we were just running in the same place but not going anywhere. You're just trying to get patients out as fast as possible to free up a bed for the next patient. And when I did pediatrics, which I had never enjoyed as a student, I found that there was real joy to be had. And I remember one night I got called out to the pediatric ward to sort something out, and it was 3 a.m. on a bitterly cold Johannesburg winter's night, and I was wrapped up and cursing and walking through the corridors of Barra, which are open, to get to the ward. And I arrived in the pediatric ward, and there was a young gentleman of about 4, and he was awake and standing up in his cot, and he saw me and he blew a raspberry. He just went and I just burst out laughing, and for the next 2 minutes we just blew raspberries at each other. And I can remember thinking to myself at that time, I cannot think of another specialty that would make me laugh at 3 a.m. on a bitterly cold morning. And it was at that moment, I think, that I knew that while I liked the cerebral aspect of adult medicine, it was the emotional joy and connection to children from pediatrics that really appealed to me.
Goodness, Alistair. Well, you'd have to be tough nonetheless. I mean, as you said earlier, you became a doctor to help people. And when you're dealing with children, it requires a little more toughness, but such gentleness as well. And as you read at the beginning of the threads, they've got minds of their own, and they know what they're about.
They sure do. We underestimate the wisdom of children, and we underestimate that children are able often to cut through all the nonsense to find what really matters. And I think with that thread that I read, you know, we see that. We see that the children were able to say, this is what really matters, everybody. All the other stuff is extraneous nonsense that distracts us. Really, what we should all be focusing on is friends, family, books, pets, ice cream, the beach. And if you smush all of those things together, the result is happiness.
Your next piece of music, Alistair, is called Epica, Never Enough.
Another symphonic band, similar to Within Temptation, also Dutch, I believe, similar with a sort of a bombastic female vocalist. If you didn't like Within Temptation, probably now you should go to the bathroom or make yourself a cup of coffee. If you did like the previous song, you should like this one. A very popular symphonic metal band from the late 90s, early noughts. I hope people like it.
Now, that was a group called Epica, and the song was called Never Enough, on a rather different music playlist here on Fine Music Radio on People of Note. But I'm giving Dr. Alistair McAlpine some leeway here because of this fascinating book he's written called A Prescription Ice Cream. And we've spoken about your time at Barrow Granith, and then you left and went into palliative care for pediatrics. Now, in the book, the second section is where you dealt with your alcohol thing, isn't it, mostly?
That's correct. So the book is not linear. It starts with the internship at Barrow Granith, and it talks about that, and then it goes back in time to the alcoholism when I was a medical student, and then it ends with the pediatric palliative care. That's not some sort of trickery that we're trying to do. I think the feeling was that starting, if we were to go on a linear fashion and start off with the rehab, that would be quite a heavy place to start. So we started more on the entertaining, interesting Barra section, and then talking a bit about the rehab, and then ultimately ending on the palliative care. Mm-hmm. So I think that different people can get different things from the book depending on who they are and what they're looking for. I think physicians will enjoy the first section. Anyone who's either struggled with addiction or knows anybody or is interested will get something from the second. And then anyone who just liked the thread or is interested in pediatrics or palliative care can then take what they want from the third.
Did you consciously think of that structure when you sat down to write it? Because you said what hard work it is to write a book, remember?
It is. I knew where the book would begin, and I knew where the book would end, and the rest I sort of had to fill in. And as I was writing it, I think it became apparent that there were going to be these three very different sections. I was very worried that they would be so different that they would ultimately feel like almost three different novellas kind of smashed together. But I think, and I hope, that what they really do is provide context for the other two. Each section provides context and meaning for the other two, such that you understand them better when you get to the end. So you realize that I had to get through the Barrow Granith section to be able to become the palliative physician that I was, and that going through alcoholism and being on the other end of the stethoscope, so to speak, I think made me a kinder and more empathetic physician to be able to go into palliative care and really understand the kids. So my hope, and only the reader can decide, but my hope is that each section complements the others.
Alistair, do you have your own children?
I do. I am a fairly new father to a beautiful, charming young man who's now seven, who will be 7 months old in a few days' time. Being a father is a transformative experience, that's for sure. But I'm also chronically sleep deprived right now.
Your work with the pediatrics, does that affect your fathership at all? Or is it too early to tell? Or
what I would say is they're very different. And being a pediatrician doesn't necessarily make one a good father, and vice versa. They're incredibly different. And there are things I'm learning in fatherhood that I had no idea about, even though I've studied children for the better part of 15 years now. So certainly it's overwhelming and humbling at the same time, but very different.
When you were writing this book, when you decided to settle down and write it, who did you have in mind? Who did you think might enjoy it? Or did you have a big audience in mind?
I think I tried to write the book that I thought I would want to read. But I did have in mind the idea. I thought that anyone who's worked in healthcare or been healthcare adjacent in South Africa would want to read it. But the longer I wrote it, the more I realized that I think the book, I hope, transcends that one group and ultimately includes anybody who's interested in discovering what matters, what the lessons that I've learned in my time, and ultimately seeing that, you know, we can all hit rock bottom, so to speak, from an addiction perspective, and that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that sometimes going through the painful things that we go through ultimately provides us with a deeper understanding of life and gives us things that we can teach other people.
Of course, I like this quote on your book cover from Rebecca Davis. This book is like South Africa itself. Poignant, maddening, funny, and hopeful. And you certainly have been able to inject some humor into this book, which I think, bearing in mind the subject matter, is important.
Yeah, thank you. I tried hard because a lot of things that happen in medicine are funny, and I certainly don't want to give listeners the impression that this is a very, very heavy book that is just a slog and one long suffer fest. You know, I didn't feel that way writing it, and I wouldn't want anyone to feel that way reading it. There are weighty themes and there are serious things that happen, but ultimately I hope that people see that even in the darkest of times and even in the most serious of subjects, there is joy and laughter to be had. And I hope and I think that the book is ultimately one of hope and joy, and not, you know, we're all going to die and that's all that life's about, but rather, yes, life is short, but what are the things that we can do to make it as happy and joyful as possible in the short time that we have?
Now, another piece of music, Dr. McAlpine, enjoying calling you Doctor at the moment. Nightwish, Ghost Love Score. Are we in for another racket here?
This isn't a racket. I would say that Nightwish are a very famous band, and so famous, in fact, that there will be non-metalheads who will have heard of this band. They're a Finnish symphonic metal band with a very famous female vocalist who has a beautiful voice with enormous range. She can do everything from operatic highs to some quite growly lows. And this song is often listed as one of the, if not the greatest symphonic metal songs of all time. It's a little bit long, so it may have to be cut short for purposes. But for anyone who's enjoyed any of the previous stuff, Nightwish are like a legendary band. And a lot of normies, as we would call them, are big fans of Nightwish. So I don't think anyone will have to turn off at this stage. Even my long-suffering partner, when I was playing it, said, oh, yeah, that's quite nice.
Okay.
Sang my name, my longing.
Well, apparently that's called Ghost Love Score, a group called Nightwish. And another rather extraordinary choice of my guest, Dr. Alison McAlpine, where we are in fact supposed to be talking about his book that he's just written called Prescription Ice Cream, A Doctor's Journey to Discover What Matters. And I have to say, it is quite a book to read. But as you did say, Alistair, it's not all heavy and gloom and intellectual and academic. It's a jolly good read, with the possibility of shedding a tear here and there, especially in the third part where you are talking about children. But now, just before I let you go, I want to find out from someone who seems as nice as you do, what I know you explained your first experience with heavy metal music where it felt a blanket had been thrown over you and you could escape. And you still listen to heavy metal music and you still have that escape.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, like I suspect a lot of your listeners, but for fine music, there's a lot of things, not just the fact that it's very all-encompassing, but just that metal music is unafraid to be incredibly dramatic. You know, in a world in which irony seems to rule and everyone seems to see, you know, I'm not taking this very seriously, metal flies in the face of that with its screams and its yelps. So it's very intense, it's very overwhelming. But there is very much, I think, a sense, because people say, how can you like the screams? And I think certainly when I was in a bad place, there was a sense that one of the more famous death metal bands is called Cannibal Corpse, and their lead singer is a guy called Corpse Grinder, who's actually a lovely family man and a nice guy. But there's a sense that Corpse Grinder screams, so I don't have to. And there is a way that the music is a cathartic experience about letting go of your negative emotions in a way without having to resort to any kind of actual screaming or violence or anything like that. So I find the music cathartic. I find it interesting. I find it emotional. And I talk quite a lot about it in the book, about how this was all sparked by a single band called Deaf Heaven, who play an extreme form of metal called black metal, which is typically known for being very fast, very dark, very dissonant, very listener unfriendly. And yet there is something there that appeals to a lot of people, that it strikes a core and a truth that appeals to a lot of us. And I think that's ultimately what got me into metal, was I was able to resonate with this extreme band. And I wanted more of that sensation.
Are you implying that there are categories for metal music?
There sure are. I mean, metal is such a huge, all-encompassing genre. It's a little bit like rock. There's so many different types of rock. There's so many types of metal. And, you know, again, when I usually start warbling about this, most of my friends, their eyes kind of glaze over. But broadly speaking, for your listeners who are interested, there are four main subcategories, and that would be thrash, so epitomized by Metallica, Iron Maiden, Anthrax or Megadeth. There would be sort of doom metal, so that would be, the most famous doom bands would be Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne, and then there's death metal. Famous bands include, you know, the band Death, who I love, as well as a whole bunch of others, and then there's black metal, which is the other one that I like. And black metal is sort of epitomized by the Norwegian bands of the early 90s. And I'll leave it at that. But if anyone wants to discuss more, hit me up on social media. I'd be happy to talk more metal anytime.
Gosh, and you seem like such a nice person. I mean, I had to say that, Alistair.
No, it's funny you said that, because there was a young gentleman I was treating who had a terrible form of cancer, and he was a teenager, and he hated everybody, and he wouldn't talk to anybody. And one day, I went into the room to try and see if I could get to him, and he was wearing a shirt of a metal band that I loved. And I was able to say to him, I know that band. And he was like, no, you don't. No one likes this band. And I said, well, I know who they are, and I like them. And that was the moment at which we were able to get a breakthrough over a shared love of this awful music. And I remember that was the start of a relationship that ultimately worked beautifully. And I can remember coming out of the room, and his dad took me aside and said, you don't really like that garbage, do you? And I said, well, actually, you know, I do. And I think it was that authenticity that resonated with this young man. So, yes, I do love this awful music, and I welcome anyone who would like to join me, but I acknowledge that it's certainly not for everybody.
Now, listen, Alistair, we're going to stop now before I get any more jumpy. But let me just tell you this book, this fascinating book, Prescription Ice Cream, A Doctor's Journey to Discover What Matters by Alistair McAlpine, is published by Pan Macmillan.
That's correct.
And it's on our shelves, isn't it?
Here, yes, available in all good bookstores. I would love it if you would grab a copy. And it's been a real pleasure and a privilege to be able to share my loud, noisy music with you. Thank you so much.
Alistair, it's been great. Thank you very much, Alistair McAlpine. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
FMR 101.3 FM.